Welcome back, everyone, to the XCast. The truth is in here. I'm Tony Black, your host, and this week we are moving the goalpost again slightly because we're not doing an episode. We're going to do another interview, and it's my absolute pleasure to get on one of the, I would say, leading X-Files theologians. That's the right word. It's Mr. John Kenneth Muir. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here, Tony.
Oh, well, we're the happy ones as fans, because it's great to get you on, John, to talk about who you are and everything like that. But principally, and I'm sure most X-Files fans know who you are, but principally to talk about your X-Files book, The X-Files FAQ, which the subtitle goes, All That's Left to Know About Global Conspiracy, Aliens, Lazarus Species, and Monsters of the Week, which is a comprehensive look at The X-Files, but not just a typical episode guide breakdown, but a real set of in-depth essays and analysis of what the show means and its place in the cultural zeitgeist and everything. And it is a terrific book. I've said that to you off air, John, but I'm going to say it again because I need people to know. It's great. So thank you so much for writing it in the first place.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. And I appreciate that so much. The fact that you like it, you know, means a lot to me because I am a huge X-Files fan, and this is sort of the book I dreamed of writing about the X-Files. My only regret is that I couldn't cover every single episode in depth because I had a word limit, so I had to really try to pick, you know, what I was going to include. So my only regret is that I couldn't cover absolutely every single episode at the level of depth that I did some. But hopefully there's still enough that you get a sense of, you know, what the series value is as a work of art, you know, from the 1990s and even how it affects us today.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You really do, you know, and because the book obviously, and we will get into talking a little bit more about the book later, but it goes in through not just each season of the show and then breaks down certain episodes, as you say, not all of them, but certain key ones. But, you know, right. It's got specific pieces on the different monsters of the week and the different concepts of supernatural in the show and how it affects American culture. There's a great deal to the book. And there's, so for anyone who might have thought that this could, and I'm not sure everyone did, but anyone who might have thought this was a traditional episode guide kind of thing, it's for much, much more than that. So it's great to have a book that really gets under the skin of the X-Files, I think.
Oh, I love that. That's such an X-Files, great X-Files term, the skin of the show. That's it. That's great. That could be an episode title, Skin.
It's a shame I didn't give you that a year or 18 months ago. You could have put it on the book. But yeah, before we do talk more about the book itself, I wanted to start by asking you, John, as a fan, the five questions of X, which I ask every guest who comes on and talks about the show, whatever they're here to talk about. So to start off with, I just wanted to ask you, how did you first discover and when did you first discover the X-Files?
Well, it was early in the first season, and I was living in Richmond, Virginia, with my girlfriend, now wife, and she wanted to watch it, and I was very dismissive to my great embarrassment and shame. I thought, you know, I'd watch some of the commercials on Fox, and I thought, oh, great, you know, this is like tabloid television. This is going to be, you know, some ridiculous, you know, National Enquirer type TV show. So I thought, I you know, I would not deign to watch this. She said, yeah, she put it on anyway. And so I was like doing other things, and, you know, I kind of kept gravitating back to the show. And I think the first episode I watched all the way through was Fire. And I mean, people may not consider that one of the greatest shows, but I mean, really, you know, there are very few poor or even just average X-Files episodes. I mean, and it grabbed me. And I thought, this is really interesting. Boy, was I wrong in my prejudice of it. So that was the first one I watched. And then I guess I watched the next week. And I mean, then it was over. I was hooked. That was it. All I had to do was be exposed to it really for 1 hour. And I could see that it was, you know, moving on beyond anything that a show with a horror oriented show with regular characters had ever been able to do. I mean, in its first weeks, it had already leapfrogged over you know, many series in the past, like Friday the 13th series or things like that, where you had continuing characters bracing with the supernatural. Even Kolchak, and I say that as an apology to Kolchak fans, because I certainly love the Night Stalker, but, you know, the X-Files sort of just took off right out of the gate. So that was really how I got exposed to it.
You first saw Mulder's Fear of Fire, which was so important to him, it was never mentioned again in the entire show.
Absolutely. you wouldn't think that would be the episode that hooked me, but that was the episode that was on, and it was good enough to to whet my appetite and get me in.
And it had Mark Shepard, and you can't go wrong with Mark Shepard. Absolutely. Really. He's great in everything he does. Okay, that's great. That's really good. My next question then is, what is your favorite episode of the X-Files? Is it Fire?
It's not Fire. That might be a sentimental choice. It's true. It's not Fire. That is so hard for me to pick. You know, I have a couple standards that I go by, because, you know, there are so many good episodes, so many great episodes of the show. But the ones that I tend to go back to, I think about The Host, of course, which, you know, is just an incredibly disgusting but fantastic episode for the way that it looks at, like, the aspects of a modern industrial society that nobody talks about, like, what do you do with your sewage, you know? I mean, that's just amazing to have an episode delve into that, you know, and it's got, like, Russian, you know, Chernobyl mutants and stuff like that. It's a pretty inventive episode. Plus, it plays on, you know, a perfect kind of fear, you know, that you're going to sit on the toilet and there's going to be, you know, a fluke man down there waiting to bite you on your butt. You know, it's just it works on so many different levels. So the ones I typically mention are The Host, Bad Blood, which is just a total meta sort of breakdown of the X-Files format. It just totally dissects the format and lets you see things in a new perspective, which I love. I love Home. That's the other one I typically mention, with the peacocks. I mean, I watched that when it aired, you know, on the network. Only aired once here in America on network television. And I could not believe what I was seeing, but I knew I loved it. You know, there's just so many. I love Postmodern Prometheus. Mm. There are so many great episodes. Trying to pick one is, for me, an impossible task.
I should have asked you, what is your favorite episode each season? That might have been fairer to do. Oh.
So I could give you 10 now if we include last run or the limited events. Right. That's a good modification of that question.
Yeah. What would you say though that your favorite season is? Because you know, if there's obviously, you know, there are great episodes scattered all over the entire show, but do you have a particular season that leaps out at you as being the show at its best?
You know, I'm going to be the worst interview you've ever had, because I'm going to say it's so hard for me to pick. It depends very much what I'm, you know, what I'm into. I think as I watched the show the first time, I was like, for me, like, seasons 1 through 4 were just sort of, you know, perfect and pristine. And very much established what I was interested in, which was like this continuing horror series that has all this sort of commentary about American life. But when I've rewatched it in recent years, I've really come to appreciate what each season has done. I rewatched the 5th season, which of course is a shorter season, and I rewatched and I thought, oh my gosh, this is like a near perfect season. I never realized as I was watching it, perhaps because it was the 5th one I watched, you know, how many of the episodes just sort of hit on all thrusters, you know. And then the 6th season was this opening up of the format with a lot more science fiction concepts. The humor was fully developed. You know, a kind of a different show, but in its 6th year, you know, that's okay, because it has to grow. It has to evolve. I've developed a deep appreciation for the 8th year and how they had to sort of proceed both with and without Mulder, and how they introduced Doggett. You know, I think I typically say my least favorite season was the 7th, but I even watched that one recently and I thought, you know, there were some incredibly ambitious sort of out of the box type episodes there. So I can't even really say that anymore. But, you know, if I really had to pick, I'd say it was going to be this is terrible. Oh, only half the show. 2, 3, 4, or 5. You know, one of those, depending on my mood.
Do you know what? I honestly, I think that's. I really.
I'm sorry, that's the one.
I really think that's a fair answer, honestly, because the thing is, you've got great episodes in all of those seasons, and if you could combine the best of each of those seasons in one season, you would have like maybe one of the perfect seasons of TV. So it's perfectly fair, I think, to pick depending on the day you're watching it. So I think most people tend to think that that's the show at its best. Right. I do love the fact that you mentioned season 8, though, because any excuse I will get to champion season 8 on this show, I will take, because I think it's really good. And most people, especially at the time, people wrote it off.
I'm totally with you on that, Tony. I thought season 8 was remarkable. I missed having Mulder there all the time, but I thought they did a great job introducing Doggett and having Scully figure out what her place was. And they really regrounded many of the horror aspects and came up with some incredibly, you know, frightening and compelling shows like Via Negativa, Roadrunners, just some, you know, stark horror there, which is, you know, that's one mode I really like on the X-Files. I like my horror. So, I mean, I agree with you. I think season 8 is massively underrated. It was, to me, it was like a rebirth of the show, and you could just see everybody was, you know, jazzed and enthused about bringing in this new character and taking the X-Files to, its sort of next chapter. And you go back and watch those shows, and I can't think of a bad one, really. I'm trying to think. I guess some people didn't like Patience, but I liked it for a lot of reasons. I'm trying to think what ones people didn't like typically from season 8, but I mean, I thought it was a great season.
I think maybe Sure Kill wasn't one of the best. I think if you had to pick a dud,
you're right.
Yeah, I think Sure Kill is,
that's
a,
right.
is a bit yes. weak, but I think yeah, it's one yes. of the few duds in a really good season, and a season full of some
right.
terrific blend of mythology and standalone. So it's great that you know more people, I think, in time are starting to appreciate that season for what it was. So my next question would be, from the 5 Questions of X, who is your favourite character in the show? Now, this doesn't have to obviously just be Mulder and Scully, you know, like most people go to. It could be anybody. It could right. be a guest star, supporting, whatever. So who would you say yours is?
Oh my gosh, you're just... It wouldn't seem that these are hard questions, but they're so hard. You know, I think I would have to pick Mulder. I just would have to pick Mulder. He is, you know, this multifaceted character. I love the fact that over, you know, all the seasons, we see so clearly what his brilliance is, but also we see some of his foibles and stuff. You know, he's amazing in his brilliance. He's amazing in his imagination, and I love that so much. You know, he has such an amazing imagination that he's able to sort of pull in his learning and his imagination to synthesize that learning, you know, and approach the cases from, you know, that dual perspective of what do I know and what can I extrapolate from what I know using my imagination to explain it. I love that. I mean, that's just like, in TV history, that's just a genius way to approach a character. But I also love, you know, this idea of these ideas about that, you know, he's a shut in, you know, after the series, he's sitting in his little room, you know, obsessively compulsively, you know, clipping out, you know, stories that strike his fancy, you know, throwing his pencils up against the ceiling, you know, to the ceiling, you know, he's a quirky person, and maybe quirky isn't the right word, because that suggests, you know, like a trifle or something like that. But I mean, he's a fully developed character, you know, in the sense that he's both brilliant and he's also, you know, kind of messed up. He's, you know,
yeah.
he can't really have a relationship with a woman other than Scully. You know, he can't throughout the series. It's funny when he has to give dating advice, you know, in Rain King and things like that, because obviously he's got no experience, right?
Yeah.
You know, his crazy fascination with Elvis, you know, porn.
Oh, yeah.
Know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's just great. He has so many nuances, I think, as a character. And, you know, I think I could say the same for Scully. And I think, honestly, if I were looking at the arc of the X-Files over these last years, I would say that it developed Mulder sort of first and superbly, and then started developing Scully, and has gotten to the same point with her. I mean, I really like the person that Scully has become after this last season, things like that. You know, I think that, you know, typically people don't like the ninth season, but you talk about an episode like Improbable and what it's saying about her and what kind of journey she's on and where she is on that journey. I mean, yeah, Mulder is my favorite, but, you know, Scully is the other, you know, lens, the other lens in our glasses. So we need her too. And they've done a great job, I think, of developing her just as much.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. They're two so well-rounded characters. And, you know, it's partly for the fact they had so many episodes to do that, but it's still just the quality of the writing and the performances. And even now, you know, even now we're still exploring them and finding new ways to enjoy these characters, you know, nearly 25 years on. So it's amazing, really. So, no, Mulder makes sense as an answer, completely.
I think what Scully has come to develop, which maybe she didn't develop at first, were some of those foibles. I feel like it took them a little longer to figure out how to write Scully, but then they really did, you know, then they really sort of nailed down that character too. And I just sort of love how she was in this tenth season, six episode series. You know, she seems a little more world weary, but she also doesn't seem so hard and fast in her views. And I like that, because to me, what that says is that Chris Carter didn't succumb to any pressure to ignore the eighth and ninth season of the series, which I assume, you know, I mean, there are a lot of fans who would be just as happy if you did that. If, like, you ignored her growth because they didn't like not having Mulder, and, you know, you just went back to sort of a pre-season eight Scully. And I think it's a true credit to him as a creator and an artist that he did not do that.
Absolutely. Because at the end of the day, much as a lot of people at the time especially didn't like the fact that Mulder was taken out of the game, it was more a choice governed by, you know, David Duchovny and a lot of other factors that Mulder left. You know, I mean, it wasn't necessarily an original choice of Chris Carter. You know, he worked with what he was able to do because they wanted to keep the show going. So it was, you know, and they did it really well. And I think that Scully really did change over those two seasons, those last two seasons, because she had to. And the fact they've kept that
absolutely,
and the fact they've kept that weaved into her character. And now, what I really like about now we're at the end of season 10. You know, season 10 has a lot of criticisms from a lot of people, but I think those two are not the same people that they were in the pilot. I think Mulder and Scully in the last season were really really good, because you felt you could see their growth and their development and everything like that. So it was it's great. It's a great position there. They're in now, really, as characters. But that's great, John. That's brilliant. Thank you for answering the five questions of X. And people have now got a good example of your X-Files fandom. So let's talk more about the book, John. Let's talk about the X-Files FAQ, which, of course, has a foreword by Chris Carter himself. Which is really exciting. How did he come to write the foreword for you?
I was so grateful to Chris Carter for writing the foreword. What had happened was that we became acquainted in 2008 because I was a very strong supporter of the X-Files, I Want to Believe. I thought that it was a beautiful and very well-crafted film that was had some difficult subject matter, so people couldn't get past it, but I thought that it was a much better movie than people gave it credit for, and I felt critics were unfair to it. And I guess my review was sort of one of the few positive reviews for the film, and I just became an ardent defender of the film. And then later that year, I guess it was 2009, I announced that it was like my birthday on the blog, and I got a message from Chris Carter saying happy birthday.
Oh, wow.
Which was just so nice. Yeah. I mean, he's just such a nice person. And I, of course, was absolutely opportunistic and said, hey, since you contacted me, why don't we do an interview for my blog?
Nicely done.
And he was very nice. He has always been so supportive of my work. And we did an interview on the blog. I think it was in December of 2009. And we talked about the film, the X-Files, Millennium, a whole bunch of things. And, you know, my respect for Chris Carter, I mean, I just think he's an amazing artist. And when I was writing my earlier book for the FAQ series, it was, I guess it was in maybe 2012, 2013. It was the Horror Films FAQ. It's sort of an overview of horror films. And, you know, I wanted to have somebody write the FAQ introduction there, or a foreword rather. And the first person I thought of was him. So I contacted him and he said, yes, absolutely, I'll do it. And he wrote a great foreword for that book where he talked about his early and enduring love for Creature from the Black Lagoon and how that impacted the X-Files and the episode The Host, which I said was one of my favorite episodes. So I got a great foreword for that book. And then it came time to do another FAQ. And as you might guess, these books are a lot of work. I mean, they take a long time. I mean, they're big books. And they were looking for a subject for me to do. And I said, the only other FAQ I want to do, you know, for that length of that amount of time that I'm going to put into it, it would have to be the X-Files. I said, I want to do an X-Files one because there was a Star Wars one, a Walking Dead, you know, there was Star Trek, stuff like that. I said, well, let me do the X-Files. And so they said yes. And I thought, well, I know exactly who I'm going to contact. Yeah. Chris Carter. And again, he just came through for me in spades because he was actually working on the set. I think he was the days he was writing the foreword for me. I think that was like he was directing an episode, oh, you know, cool. Of the limited series. So
yeah,
he just came through for me. I mean, he's come through for me many times. He's supported, you know, my work many times, and I'm just eternally grateful. So I was so delighted to have, you know, his account from, you know, the set of the X-Files, you know, limited series,
yeah,
writing this foreword. I thought, well, that's just it. I mean, and, you know, the thing is, when I got the contract to do this book and I started writing it, no one still knew what was happening. So it's like it all happened like at the same time. And then it looked like, well, this book is going to be coming out at the same time. There's like surprise going to be a 6-episode series of the X-Files. So I couldn't have asked for it all to, you know, dovetail better. And for him to be able to report, you know, from directing an episode about what was happening, you know, it was amazing that, you know, those things never happen. I've been writing books, you know, I'm old. So, I've been writing books since I was 24 years old, I guess 1994. I've never had everything just like come together sort of like that. So
it's great as well that you managed to get references to the new C. I know obviously the book came out before the new revival series came out, but you managed to get some references to the fact that it's coming back and, you know, it's on the horizon into the book. So that was that. Yeah, the timing was really fortuitous there, wasn't it? Which is tremendous.
It so was. I mean, I couldn't believe it because you know how the process with a book works is you sort of write it. You get everything you need, you put it together, and then like somebody edits it, and like 6 months later you get it back, and you respond to the edits, and then it goes to print. So it's like, you know, in the original version of the book, I was still talking about X-Files 3 a little more significantly and not talking about the series, but then I got it back for editing and I knew what was going on. So I was like, okay, well, you know, I'm gonna try to like make it sound, you know, try to get the in the little spots where I can say it's coming back so that it could be more up to date. So that really worked out, I think.
Yeah, it really, really did. You know, and it places the book in a really interesting position between all the previous seasons and everything like that, and the movies and the new season. So it's great. I think in terms of the content of the book, one thing that stuck out for me immediately when I started reading it was this idea of the Pax America, or as you call it, the American peace. And it's basically this idea of a time in the 1990s that was without conflict between the Cold War and the what we call the War on Terror, and where the X-Files was able to grow. So how do you feel that all this, I mean, obviously you talk about it in the book, but how do you feel this informed the X-Files and what Chris Carter created?
Well, I feel that I don't want to sound too fawning, but you know, I just feel that Chris Carter is, I really feel like he is a visionary, and what the core of his work is, in some sense, even if you look at Millennium and even Harsh Realm to a degree, I think that there's this sort of anticipatory anxiety. It's this sort of knowledge of how human history moves in cycles from conflict to peace and then back to conflict, and that there are certain people and certain events that might be the canary in the coal mine for what that next conflict is going to be, but it is inevitable that there is going to be that next conflict. And the X-Files and Millennium really arrive smack in the middle of this time where we all thought, yeah, we've got this nailed. You know, we're America, we're the lone superpower. We have now this new technology, the internet, which is going to make information available to everybody. We have this new science, which is going to open the doorways to new understanding of what human beings are, you know, the Human Genome Project. And I feel like Chris Carter was able to sort of look at all these things and say, well, let's look at history. How have we dealt with technological advances before? And you know, I think what he saw was a comparison like between, okay, well, yeah, we split the atom. How did we use it? We used it to, you know, drop bombs on Japan first off. Okay. And then, so how are we going to use genetic science? What is it going to be for? And within that sort of nutshell, you have the kernel of what the conspiracy in the X-Files is to some degree. I mean, and also he saw how, you know, the Nazis and some Japanese scientists in World War II, how they treated their advances at their time. And he said, you know, we're still the same beings 50 years later. We're going to have these sort of abuses or pushes too far in science. He was able to see that the internet could be not only a place of democracy and joining, but a place of disinformation. I mean, certainly you see that. I mean, people used to think pretty fondly of WikiLeaks. It's pretty clear now WikiLeaks is in the hands of a foreign power that's out to disrupt an American election and hand it to somebody that they would rather have in charge. That, you know, there are, you know, he was in this time of peace, but instead of saying, you know, everything's great, he's saying, no, you need to look over the next hill and what's going to be happening with technology, what's going to be happening with science, and you know, even to some extent, crime. I think, you know, that might be the only place we question, because certainly we know that crime rates have dropped since the 90s, but in the 80s and 90s, they were still at their peak. They've dropped significantly since then. We only feel like we're under siege because we have a 24-hour news cycle that reports every single incident of crime. But if you look at statistics, things like murder, all those things are down. But you know, what he did was he picked up on all these under the surface anxieties and his knowledge, I think, of history. And then where he brought his artistry in was his use of symbols, how he could use symbols to express these fears of what was coming down the line, and whether that symbol was Frank's yellow house in Millennium, or it was even the dual perspective nature of Mulder and Scully, our two lenses on the world in the X-Files. He was able to examine all of these things that were happening.
Yeah, and he does it very well in the revival series, doesn't he? In the mythology episodes, because, you know, in My Struggle and My Struggle 2, he presents all new fears for the American public and for beyond. And I think it's something that, you know, after the X-Files went away, which was rough, I want to believe, not discounting, but the actual TV series ended in 2002, if I remember rightly, and that was just after 9/11. And now right. It's taken, say 15 years to come back. And we're now at a point where, again, I think there's this general anticipatory anxiety, as you say, put really well, actually, about what might be coming next. Because, you know, depending on the you know, election in a month, we might have the Trump administration. You know, we're all scared of what might. And I say this as a British person, and we're as terrified of that idea as you are.
I am terrified of it. I don't know. I you know, for 4 years, God forbid, 8 years, you could wake up every day and wonder who's going to get under his skin and who, you know, what's he going to do today?
Yeah.
You know, it's a terrifying prospect.
It's scary. But again, Chris Carter seems to know the right time to to be there when we're having these fears and to how to contextualize them. And as you put it in the book, you know, in a science fiction horror, you know, paradigm, really. And I think he does that very well in the new series.
Absolutely. You know, I think when I think about the X-Files, and I wrote about this a little in the book, is that we want to go into the X-Files or something like Millennium at a time where we're not countenancing dealing with this huge external threat, because we're looking at essentially who are we? What is it in us that is doing this? And if you've got some sort of existential threat from the outside, the Cold War, the War on Terror, something like that, you know, our entertainment's all going to shift to that. I mean, and you can see that on American TV. You can see how we went from the X-Files, which is this anticipatory anxiety that something bad is going to happen, to then suddenly shows like Alias and 24 and things like that, where it's like, no, we're like stopping, you know, plans of terrorists in their step. You know, it's you know, we're trying to prevent a terrorist attack. It went from this is who we are, literally, like in the case of Millennium, to, you know, build Fortress America, keep the bad people out. That's a totally different paradigm. I mean, and that exists in horror all the time. There's the two, I think it was John Carpenter who said this, that the two types of horror stories are the terror is outside us, it's another tribe, and we have to defend ourselves against that tribe. Those stories are really easy to tell because you have a specific enemy to point at. The other kind of story is that the kernel of terror is within us, and it's here, and we don't understand it, but it's here within us. And that's the kind of story that we got in the X-Files and Millennium, is that it's here. This is who we are. The time is near. Something is going to happen, and somehow we're involved in creating that. It's a much more nuanced, subtle, difficult approach. And again, that's one reason I appreciate Chris Carter so much. It's so easy to point outside yourself and say it's this. But, you know, even the monsters in the X-Files, the monsters of the week, they are developments of us, of things we did.
Yeah.
You know? Because if you look at the ones that aren't, like say the Texan vampires in Bad Blood, they're not really bothering anybody, and they're even contextualized that way. It's like, we pay our taxes, we do, you know, we're not bothering you, just leave us alone. You know? But it's like, you know, the monsters are the things that arise because of experimentation, because of scientists run amok, because the serial killers that like in Irresistible, you know, that's arisen in us. You know, something has gone sour within us, and we have to deal with it. And, you know, he's always telling that kind of story, but you can only tell it at a certain time. You couldn't tell it right after 9/11 because no one's going to be paying attention to that. Everybody's scared to death. You know, and I mean, I know we have ISIS now, but it's not the same thing. You know, we've gotten away from, I mean, in America, we had like color coded warnings for years. It's like, oh, you're safe to go outside. Don't go outside. You know?
Yeah.
Crazy. You know, but then that went away. You know, we've started to recover, and we've started to look inward again and start to look at who we are and what's happening inside. And I mean, you can say, looking at this election, that it's pretty clear, at least to me, and maybe some of the people who listen to this are going to hate that I say this, but it's pretty clear that the big threat to America is what's in America right now. Mm. And what it is nativism, white supremacy, racism, you know, whatever you want to call it, that there's some kind of schism in us. And that's what's jeopardizing us now. And that's much more in line with what we saw, I think, in the 90s than, you know, an external threat, which we can all just galvanize against and say, let's, you know, fight Al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden, what have you.
You know, it's really fascinating because in many respects, speaking as an Englishman, we are going through very similar things right now in terms of trying to understand our own national identity. And, you know, we had the Brexit.
Oh, yes.
This summer, which did not go the way a lot of people thought it was going to go. And I'm quite happy to admit that it didn't go the way I wanted it to go.
Right. That's terrifying, too.
It is. And it means that we're on the cusp of being a very different country already. In the next few years, our country is going to change in massive ways. Ways that a lot of people who voted the other way don't necessarily, I think, completely understand, in my personal opinion. But it's that whole feeling that we're on the cusp of something big and something quite terrifying as well. And that's it's different from what's happening in America, but it shares a common DNA. And I think it's happening in a lot of other countries around the world as well. Not just the, you know, kind of Middle Eastern countries that are going through turmoil, but, you know, Western democracies all across Europe, all kinds of different places. Right now seems to, if ever a time for Millennium to come back, I think that time is now.
Absolutely.
Because there really is that horrible feeling going on in different ways in different countries. And I suspect that's why The X-Files did massively well when it came back in January. Because people are ready for it again. People are ready to, like you say, look inward.
I think so. I mean, I think that's brilliant what you said and how you connected it to Brexit. I mean, it's very much of the same thing. And what it is, it's a breakdown of progress. It's sort of like we've come all this way and we're getting closer to realizing that we're interdependent. We have globalism, which was a big part of both the Pax Britannia and the Pax Americana, was this, you know, you would have called it maybe colonialism in the first case, but it was where you're bringing things in from different cultures and you're giving things to different cultures. And we're taking these steps towards a deep interconnectedness. And every time you make a step like that, or two steps like that, you have the people who rebel and stop and say, we're not going to that future. Mm. We have to build a wall. We have to keep that out.
Yeah.
You know? And again, it's going to be, you said national identity. You're absolutely right. I mean, what we're talking about is, you know, our national identity going to be that we cower behind a wall, and that we, you know, the Statue of Liberty, it doesn't say, you know, give me your white male Christian rich people. You know, that's not what it says. You know, is that what it's going to mean? You know, is that what America is going to mean, you know, for the next 4 or 8 years, that, you know, that's all we're willing to accept and have, and that we're going to stop progress cold? You know, it's very frightening, and I'm hoping that The X-Files is back soon, because there's this whole context which I feel like it would very strongly be exploited. I know Chris Carter would have some amazing thoughts about this, and, you know, I want that next season, because, you know, it's a very scary time for our cultures. I mean, people say, yeah, but nothing has happened. Well, you have those canaries in the coal mine. Brexit was one. Trump is another. You know, it's, you know, I think if we have a President Trump, we're there.
Yeah.
we're officially there. You know, that's,
and it would be very interesting to see where a season 11 of The X-Files sat in that. You know, in Chris Carter writing a new season and the rest of his writers writing a new season in the Trump, you know, presidency. And that's, you know, not that they would necessarily directly bring the Donald Trump into The X-Files as president, obviously, or reference it, but it's there. It's definitely there. So it's going to be very interesting, really. Looking back then, you also talk about the historical context of the show. That's another fascinating, you know, part of the book at the start. You know, and you talk about, you know, beyond Kolchak, which everybody obviously knows as the main inspiration for Chris Carter, you know, Kolchak the Night Stalker from the 1970s. You know, shows like The Invaders or One Step Beyond, shows that, you know, not necessarily everyone will have heard of. You know, so people who watch The X-Files may have heard of The Invaders because of Roy Thinnish, you know, and as Jeremiah Smith. But they won't necessarily have seen them. So do you think that the show, The X-Files, could have really ever existed without these earlier touchstones?
You know, it's so interesting to me because, you know, Chris Carter is such a fascinating person to me because he, you know, he's not somebody who is, like, indoctrinated in TV like Star Trek. He's not, you know, he didn't watch Star Trek, you know? And so the question is, could he have, you know, taken the tide of the culture and come up with this without those things? You know, possibly. I don't know. You know, it's so hard to say, you know, because, you know, you have one talent and his sort of genius for reading the culture and pulling it together. And there was really nothing like it in those times. You know, as far as the antecedents, though, we know, like, the paranormal had a voice in One Step Beyond. That was all paranormal stories, but there were no regular characters, no continuing characters. We know Kolchak gave us the monster of the week and continuing characters, and there was very much a post-Watergate milieu to that. So I do feel like Chris Carter watched that, and Watergate was so important to him that I do feel like Kolchak is really strongly embedded, but I also feel like whether consciously or unconsciously, he also saw what the weakness of Kolchak was, which is that it was somebody alone who was facing these monsters, and each week there was sort of no development or growth of it, and he had nobody really to talk to or trust. And, you know, The X-Files modifies that so beautifully because, you know, we have stories, we have an arc, we have the myth arc. So it's like, oh, if you see a monster this week, you're going to remember next week that you saw a monster. You know, Kolchak doesn't have that. It's like those stories could all be happening in alternate universes because he doesn't really – they don't really build on each other, you know? And then he also gave – Scully and Mulder each other, so that it wasn't just like this thing, one person against the world, you know, against City Hall, and they never make any progress and they never have anybody they can relate to. You know, Kolchak never really had anybody. I mean, he had his editor who didn't believe him, you know, and he had, there were a couple regular characters in the newsroom who would show up on a recurring basis, but there was nobody who was like always on his side, and there was no recourse for him. You know, he was always going out defeating the monsters on his own. So, you know, I think you do needed you did need Kolchak. I think Chris Carter watched Kolchak, but I think he figured out quite adroitly how to improve on the Kolchak format. Thing, you know, I don't think he ever saw Beyond Reality or The Sixth Sense or things like that. I mean, those are, you know, I think those are antecedents in the sense that they were prehistoric attempts in some senses to tell these stories in a way that the audience could accept. But either TV wasn't ready for them in the sense that all stories were, you know, you forgot next week, one week, what was happening the week before. There was no buildup. TV shows weren't like novels. So, you know, there was that. And I guess for some reason they didn't see the need to, you know, have partners at least starting out. I mean, that was something that began like with shows like Friday the 13th part, the series in the 80s and Beyond Reality. You know, I do think that Chris Carter was influenced by Twin Peaks to some extent. I think he saw that he can go out into these kind of strange places and develop a universe of people that you can come back to, even if you're not necessarily in that sort of soap opera mode. But I mean, I find it fascinating. I remember all those shows. Even the bad ones I covet because I do tend to think, look at history, look at what was there and look at how it develops. But you know, again, it's like, you know, I can look back and I can tell you, oh, Star Trek was like, you know, Forbidden Planet, you know, but Gene Roddenberry also imbued it with his, you know, vision of man for mankind in the future. So it wasn't just like a knockoff of Forbidden Planet. It was like a building off of that. You know what I mean? And I definitely think the X-Files builds off of Raiders of the Lost Ark, believe it or not, you know, with the idea, you know, with the approach to government and that warehouse at the, you know, in the Pentagon and, the, you know, I think it was a building off of things like Twin Peaks and Kolchak. All those other things are there, but you know, if I were to get to interview Chris Carter again, I say, "Were you aware of this?" And I have the feeling he would say, "No, I never watched those." I mean, those aren't that easy to find, those shows, you know.
No, they wouldn't be now. You know, they are a bit. You know, some of them I hadn't heard of till I read your book, to be honest. So it was, you know, I'm like, wow, okay, that's something that's interesting. You also in the book look at all the different mythological elements to the show. You know, not just exploring each season and the specific episodes, but also, you know, going into depth about the actual. The monsters, elements of the religion, the supernatural, you know, and you talk in detail about a lot of the reference points and a lot of the, you know, contextualization of these in terms of other kinds of movies and TV shows and things like that. But if you were to look at all of these different elements, where do you think the X-Files is the strongest in terms of when it's dealing with, is it when it's dealing with religion? Is it when it's dealing with monsters of the week or the alien myth arc? You know, where do you think the show really strikes the biggest chord, or is it all of them?
I think this is going to sound crazy. Because it's like, wow, I'm just like totally like worshiping the show. But the thing is this, you know, for me, a great work of art, like a TV show or a film, it has to soak in that context that's around the world, that's happening there, the zeitgeist. And then it has to reflect it back in a way that's meaningful and that people say, okay, I understand how this affects me. And so it's got to have that social commentary aspect. But here's the thing, because I'm sort of a stickler for this, and this is a clear reason why I just love the X-Files, is the cinematic visualization of those themes. It has to – the form has to be able to like raise that content, you know, to the highest level. That's like that's the apex for me. Now, that's not the apex for everybody. You can have Marxist critics, feminist critics, you know, simply, you know, people who are simply looking at narrative, things like that. For me, like a TV show, a film, what makes it great is when its theme reflects the culture and sort of mirrors that theme back to the culture. Say, this is who you are, but it does it in such a visually adroit way that you're carrying with you not only the words the people are saying, but the visuals, the symbols, things like that. Everything is working together towards that point for you to recognize what this is, for you to understand what's coming back at you. It's like, okay, you know, it's played off of this, it's been twisted a little, but this is really a discussion of this, that, or the other thing, and they've done it in this in this visual fashion with, you know, with imagery, with how the camera moves, you know, just things like that. And to me, that's what makes me love the X-Files just so much, is that it brought cinematic visuals to television. And, you know, Chris Carter is extremely modest. You know, we didn't know what we didn't know. You know, we didn't know, we didn't even know we were doing this, but we figure out very, you know, very shortly that how we had to move the camera and how we had to visualize things. And it's just brilliant the way it does it. I mean, I wrote a book, Horror Films of the 90s, and a key aspect of that book, you know, horror movies in the 90s were hitting a tough spell. You know, people like John Carpenter, Wes Craven, Tobe Hooper weren't having hits. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that. Again, horror movies typically don't thrive when things are good in the culture. They thrive when things are bad in the culture. And it was sort of a peaceful time. But I say the other key thing is the X-Files. Let's look. X-Files went from, you know, was on the air seven years in the 90s, 93 to 99. It was on after that. But, I mean, I was looking at horror films in the 90s. And, okay, so it was on Friday nights. When do you go see a movie? Friday night, right? It was on Friday nights before it moved. Okay, so the first 3 years, it was on Friday nights. And like I said, it almost never had a bad episode. It was filmed like a horror movie. You got your vampires, you got your werewolves, you got your, you know, anything a movie could do, the X-Files week after week was doing it better.
Yeah.
Why did horror movies have a tough time in the 90s? Well, they were up against this juggernaut of the X-Files, where it was triumph week after week after week. And people were like, oh, I'm going to go out and pay $14 to watch some movie that sucks, or I can stay home and get my scares from this hour of the X-Files. I mean, you know, that's what was happening. You know, the X-Files brought cinematic visuals to TV. And you look at, where did those people go from the X-Files? Okay, well, they went to Breaking Bad. They went to Game of Thrones. They went to 24. I mean, the writers, directors, all those people are now responsible for what people see as the golden age of TV, which we're in right now, where now TV shows are far more artistic in many sense than movies. Because now movies, it's like, oh, we have to appeal to everybody on the opening weekend, so let's just make a superhero movie. And it won't be about anything because we don't want to offend anybody. So you get like tons of superhero. It's like what TV used to be, pitched to the lowest common denominator. Yeah. Whereas now we have TV and you have all these different channels to choose from. Like, you're picking the best stuff, like The Man in the High Tower. Did I get the title right? The Man in the High Castle? What is it called? I love the show. I can't believe I got the title wrong. Game of Thrones, Walking Dead, you know, all of these shows are developments of what the X-Files spearheaded in the 90s, which was, you couple really complicated narratives and themes with the cinematic possibilities of film, and you have the world we're in now. And that's why I love the X-Files so much. And I think – So for me, it's like, I can't untangle them. It's like, I love their social commentary, and I love that they hit religion, and that they hit, you know, bureaucracy, and they, you know, all these things, that they hit big business. They, you know, just so many different things. And they did it with this great cinematic style. So for me, it's like, I mean, that's just perfect. That's like the ideal. If the new Star Trek could do that, that would be great.
I'll give you another one that's just started, that is a good example of this: Westworld. Which,
and I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, John, you are going to love it. You are absolutely going to love it. It is, believe the hype on that one, because it is absolutely fantastic. It's got so much depth and so much commentary on not just like religion and faith and everything, but on actual narrative. It's like a meta story about the meaning of narrative in the future, to do with gaming and all this kind of, it's marvelous. Check it out. It definitely,
I need to. I've read so many good things about it. That's the, I think I'm just waiting so I can binge watch it, you know. I've gotten so I don't know what the word is. It's like, I just want to binge watch stuff now. It's like, if I have to wait a week now, I'm so spoiled. I guess that's the word. It's like, no, I want to wait till the season's done and then watch them all together.
I know it feels. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm like that with Game of Thrones. Watching it weekly is hell.
It is. Absolutely. I say, no, I'm doing them season at a time. I cannot do that. Same with Walking Dead. I know it's going to come back. And it's like, yeah, no, I'm not watching 1 week at a time. I have to get my like intense fix of it, you know?
Save them up, yeah. It's funny we're talking about this, because my next question is all about influences, because you touch on the range of 90s shows that came after The X-Files. And you, honestly, reading this, it was a trip down memory lane for me, because I remember in the 90s all of them being on Sky One in the UK. Things like Nowhere Man and American Gothic and things I'd forgotten about, like Prey. You know, it's reading it, I was like, oh my God, this is brilliant. Brimstone, I was reading all this kind of, this is fantastic. And Fringe, which interestingly you don't seem a big fan of, actually, which is interesting, because that was arguably, as you say in the book, the most popular after The X-Files. And many people went, oh, it's the new X-Files. Do you think anything, though, has lived up to The X-Files yet? Any of these imitators or anything that followed, really?
No, I don't. I just spit that one out. You know, Fringe, you know, okay, I like J.J. Abrams. I think he's a talented guy. I like Star Trek Beyond very much. I thought it was although he didn't direct that one. Okay, but that doesn't fit my argument.
He was
okay.
Involved. He was involved. You can get away with it.
But, you know, he seems somebody to me who is very good about understanding the form of something and able to ape a form without really, beyond a superficial level, creating something. And so I typically find his work somewhat shallow, beautiful to watch, but it's like, you know, it is like John Carpenter's The Thing. It's like, okay, here's this Star Trek thing, and they capture so much, but underneath it, it's a thing. It's not Star Trek.
Yeah.
Oh, and I like the reboots. I'm sorry to use that as an example, but I guess I'm trying to get to Fringe. Fringe, to me, understood what the forms of the X-File were. You had to have the conspiracy, you had to have the partners, you had to pull in the FBI, you had to have all these things. Underneath it all, I felt like, you know, it was like a flat line. You know, and I know a lot of people like it. If you like it, I apologize. Because it's not that other people can't have other opinions of it. absolutely. And not that those opinions, I'm not saying mine is right and yours is wrong. You know, maybe my analytical whatever skills failed me, that I saw it in light of being an X-Files ripoff, and I never was able to get under that and see what else it was. You know, I've often thought about going back and rewatching and giving it a second chance. But as far as those other shows in the 90s, I mean, you got it. The X-Files is the most influential TV series in history. That's a big statement, but think how many shows it inspired. I mean, you can think about, well, what did Star Trek inspire? I mean, how many other space shows? There are a couple, sure. But I mean, like the X-Files, I mean, we're talking about, what is it, a half dozen? I mean, yeah. So many, you know, you may have named them. Nowhere Man, American Gothic, Brimstone, Prey, Dark Skies, Sleepwalkers. Yeah. Okay, that's six right there. You can just go on and on. I mean, Burning Zone, which was god awful. You know, and it isn't, and they were clever, because each show tried to siphon off a piece of it. Dark Skies was like the conspiracy and aliens, and Nowhere Man was just like the conspiracy, and Burning Zone was like the disease stories. Yeah. they were trying to siphon off the life of the X-Files into all these like specialized pieces. You know, and the result of that was that there was nothing as deep or as complex as the X-Files. You know, the only thing that I think stands beside the X-Files, honestly, and you can put them side by side, is Millennium. You put those two series side by side, and you have a perfect description, a perfect depiction of that anticipatory anxiety and who are we, you know, in the 90s, the mid to late 90s.
Which is still relevant now. You know, if you go back and you watch any of them, and I'm one of the people who would probably say that Millennium is as good as the X-Files on a good day, to be honest. I mean, I have difficulty separating the two, really, because I absolutely adore Millennium as well. It's just not the most well-known one. It's not the most pop culture one. But in fact, it's too little known for my money, really. But
absolutely.
But yeah, and you know, I mean, in terms of that inspiring, I would say to anyone, if you've ever seen Hannibal, that is Millennium for this modern age. Absolutely. Will Graham is Frank Black, as Frank Black is Will Graham from the books. So, it all comes back around, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? And it's funny, you know, I always say it's the X-Files resonated with the people, I would say, people who aren't, but you and I are talking about themes and all these deep things, and it resonated with us because that's there. Mm. But it resonated with the vast pop culture too, because you had this iconic banter between Scully and Mulder and the sexual tension between, you know, there are people who watched it not necessarily for the reasons we're talking about here. And not that those reasons, not that those reasons are wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, you have great chemistry. You're following the characters. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But you say, why did X-Files, you know, become, you know, this pop culture Leviathan and, you know, Millennium not quite as much. And I think it's because, you know, X-Files was able to also tap into some those really popular things that Millennium didn't, you know. Millennium, you know, it didn't have that. You know, Millennium had three different female leads, essentially, in three different years. You had his wife the first year, Laura Means the second year, and Emma Hollis the third year. And I was like, where's that chemistry? What are we finding? What's the place there? You know, how is that working? You know, it had so many brilliant things, but it wasn't the popular thing. You know, Frank Black was not the – you know, I don't want to say Mulder was light, but Mulder had that sense of humor, you know. And Frank Black did not. Not that there's anything wrong with him not having a sense of humor. It's like the elements that were there to like catch lightning in a bottle a second time, you know, for people like you and me, they were there.
Absolutely.
And that show is brilliant. I mean, I love it. It's a masterpiece, artistic masterpiece. But like for the vast group of people, say, like, oh, I don't know,
you know. you're so right about that. I mean, you know, even now. There are, you know, in promoting this podcast and getting to know X-Files fans, you know, I see all the time entire communities, thousands of people on things like Facebook and Twitter that are completely X-Files fans based around, as it's termed, you know, Jilovny. It's that whole, you know, Jillian and David and that whole idea that they could even be a couple in real life and the Mulder and Scully. It's what it's all about for a lot of people. It's not about, as you say, the things we're talking about, the things that Chris Carter and his writers were layering in there, and they were wanting to, you know, communicate and to talk about. So and it's wonderful to see, because these people are posting pictures of these guys from 25 years ago, you know, and every day, and everyone's liking it and going, oh, they look all lovely, and we're talking about the X-Files. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. It's just very different, and that's what's great about the X-Files and the community. And also, I have to say this, and I think it's a real plus point for the X-Files, the fact that so many fans are female. You know, in a kind of area of genre that is predominantly, you know, dominated by male fans in a lot of ways. The X-Files fan community is heavily female, and it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant, because they see Scully as a real role model and an icon. It's great.
She is. I mean, absolutely. You know, I'm sort of stunned when I go back and I watch, like, the first and second season episodes, and I see right from the beginning that, you know, she is portrayed as an equal in terms of intellect and curiosity and even physicality, you know. And I'm not shocked, because she's a woman. I mean, that's how women should be.
Yeah.
But I'm shocked that it got on TV. You know.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, they got it right from the beginning. Yeah. And accordingly, I mean, I think a generation has grown up, you know, inspired by Scully.
Totally, so many women. So yeah, the influences, you know, go beyond the TV shows that have come out, but also to, you know, how they've affected fans and everything. Just moving away, slightly from this book, but you know, you've, as you mentioned earlier, you know, you've written extensively beyond the X-Files, in everything from science fiction through to horror to movies, all kinds of things over the years, lots of genres in between. What would you say, aside from the X-Files FAQ, what would you say your favorite project has been to work on from all these different works?
Oh, golly.
That's a tough one.
it is, because, you know, it's like picking a child, you know? which one's my favorite child? You know, again, I guess I have some preferred children. My first book, first book I ever wrote, where I got to talk about, I guess it's an obscure TV series, but Space 1999, which was a show from the 70s, which, you know, people totally just railed on it and hated it, because people at that time wanted Star Trek and it wasn't Star Trek. But, you know, its first season was this sort of magnificent, crazy thing, which was about, you know, man being in space with all this technology that I think makes him great, and encountering like the totally irrational. It's like man goes out into space and he's got his spaceships and his moon base and all this. And what does he find out there? It's like the universe is H.P. Lovecraft. You know, I love that. That's to me, that's just a kind of genius concept. So I really did love writing that book, my first book. I've loved writing all my big horror film books, like horror films of the 70s, 80s and 90s. I love covering a decade and like looking at what the context was for that decade and seeing how films fit in. I cherish the opportunity to visit the X-Files now because I've always wanted to do it. And I feel like what this book gave me the opportunity to do is, you know, there's been so much amazing X-Files scholarship in terms of on the web, in print. But I thought, okay, you know, because I didn't realize it was going to be coming back right when I was writing the book. Yeah. I thought I get to talk about it now, like from the vantage point of history, because most of the books were like when it was on, you know. So it's like I can talk now, like what did it achieve 20 years ago? You know, I'm like the only person who gets to write about it in the age of Game of Thrones. And I can say, look, there's a direct line between, you know, X-Files and Game of Thrones. Why doesn't anybody see it? So it's like I just love that I was able to do that with the book. You know, I mean, I can't really pick favorites. I know those are high points for me. I wrote about the X-Files and Millennium before. In a book called Terror Television, and I have very fond memories of writing that book. It was like I covered TV series that basically like from Night Gallery to somewhere around Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So I, you know, it was like from 1970 to maybe to 1999. I guess Angel was the last one that had just started when I wrote that book. Mm. So, I mean, I like that because I love to talk about horror, and there's so many forgotten series that people don't remember. But again, I wrote about the X-Files, and I was like, man, it's the best. You know, it's like it's so nice to write this book and say, yeah, we finally have a great horror series, and here it is. So it's hard to pick a child, but I mean, I feel like those are some high points. I hope those are high points in my career.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, yeah. Terrible question from me there. That's a horrible question to ask you. But going forward then, what else? What's next? What's next in the pipeline? Another FAQ, or are you working on something completely new?
Well, you know, one of the things I hope to do, and I'm sad and I have not achieved it, is I really wanted to write a Millennium book. And there's going to be an episode by episode analysis of Millennium, but no publishers have gone for it. I was going to do it on my own, but then I've got a career as a full time instructor at a college here. I'm teaching six classes. You know, I wanted to have it out for the 20th anniversary, and it didn't happen. So I'm a little sad about that.
That's a shame.
It makes me sad, but you know, I gotta support my family. Right?
Oh yeah, no, understandable, yeah. I'd read it, John, you know.
I haven't given up hope. I'm still hoping I'm going to do it. But the book I'm like working on finishing right now is a companion to found footage horror movies. It's like I'm reviewing like hundreds of found footage horror movies, much to my wife's chagrin because she's had to watch them all. You know, I do talk about the X-Files in that book as well because, of course, there's X-Cops, and that's one of my favorite episodes. Mm. I just think
I love X-Cops.
Yeah, I mean, what a great episode. And that was sort of also, you know, it came out after Blair Witch Project, but it was still pioneering the form.
Yep.
I'm going to be talking about like some TV examples of sort of found footage or mockumentary things.
Oh, fabulous. That sounds brilliant.
Well, thank you. I like the form. I love the Blair Witch Project. I know a lot of people hate it. I think it's a work of genius, too.
Me too.
You know, it's about the same thing about the 90s, you know, and again, anticipatory anxiety. It's like, man, it like, you know, what we see on TV, you know, 9/11, things like that, you know, reality and what's on TV are really different. You know?
It's true. That sounds great. That book sounds really, really good. I can't wait to read that. That'd be great.
I will send you a copy.
Oh, please do. That'd be wonderful. Thank you. Yeah, yeah. Well, I have one last question for you, John, and this is something I ask everybody who comes onto the X-Cast, and it is simply this. Do you believe in the paranormal?
Oh. I want to believe.
Oh, excellent. You're the first person who's answered with that, actually. That's good. That's good.
Yeah. I want to. You know, I talk to my classes about this because I'm a communication instructor, and we talk about technology, and does it hinder our understanding of the world, or does it help our understanding of the world? And look at all the conspiracy. Look how we're using the web, you know, for cat videos and internet and, you know, weird conspiracies. You know, so, you know, I do think this. I mean, I really do wish it were so, because I think it would mean that there are still mysteries and there's still magic in the world that, you know, we haven't quantified yet. But I also know more people have cameras on them at all times than in any period in human history. We all have an iPhone with a camera. We are in more places than we've ever been. With GPS, we can go places we haven't gone before, and nobody has snapped a definitive picture of something like that, of you know, at least of cryptozoology, of Sasquatch or Loch Ness Monster or Slenderman or what, you know, of course.
Yeah.
We know he's fictional, of course, but so, but you know, nobody's found it. And you know, if they're there, they're just doing a great job of hiding, you know.
Yeah.
As far as other things, I'll say this: when I wrote a book about One Step Beyond, and what I tried to do was examine for each episode whether or not they were accurate to the literature about paranormal. I mean, because I can't say this is true or not true, but did they at least sort of follow like what people said? And most often they did. And the one that gave me pause, I'll say it, and the one that where I was reading stuff that just really surprised me and I couldn't sort of poke holes in the story, it was reincarnation. I have to say, it really was. Reading into the literature of reincarnation and some of the stories involving reincarnation, you go to some of the books and some of the photographs and stuff like that, it gave me pause. I don't know that I'd say I believe in it, but I'll say it gave me pause to think, okay. I mean, I really want to believe in that stuff. Do I believe in alien civilizations? I'll say yes. Do I believe they're visiting? I don't know. Yeah. But I believe somewhere out there there's an alien civilization, or there was an alien civilization. Because now people are saying, you know, we're the only ones out there now that, you know, most alien civilizations were destroyed or whatever, you know, that because of radiation, or they got to some stage of development and, you know, killed themselves. That, you know, and we haven't reached that stage yet, so we can look forward to killing ourselves.
Emphasis on yet.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Right. Yeah. That happens November 9th. Okay. that's when we destroy ourselves. So I don't know. I really do want to believe, but nothing in my life has led me to concretely believe.
Well, I think that's a good answer. I think that's a good answer. And you know, most people, when they come on and I ask them that question, or a variant of that question, because depending on the episode we ask, do you believe in whatever the paranormality is of the episode? You know, there's always usually the answer of, well, maybe, but, you know, I don't know. I've not had anyone yet who has directly experienced something that makes them go, yes, 100%, I believe that. That's definitely a thing. Maybe one day. Maybe one day.
We just need one.
I'm going to vet each guest now and say, have you had a paranormal experience? No, you can't come on the show.
That's right. You're off. You didn't. Don't come on my show unless you've had a paranormal experience.
Even though I haven't, you can't come on. Yeah. So that brings us to the end then of this this interview with John about the X-Files FAQ, which is available now from Applause Books. You can find that on Amazon and in many bookshops, I believe. And it's a terrific, terrific read for any. It's got to be an essential for any X-Files fan and fan of things like Millennium and any of the associated 90s genre TV. You know, it's even if you're new to the X-Files, pick it up because it will give you so much more in-depth analysis. You can work through it as you watch each episode. It can be a nice little companion that's very much more in-depth and different from your traditional episode guidebooks, which don't get under the skin, as I to use that again, as this book does. So absolutely check it out. It's fantastic. So thanks again, John, for writing it, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. It was a great pleasure to be here, and I had a great time. Thank you.
Oh, no, the pleasure's mine. Where can people find you or your work then? Beyond this episode?
Well, I have a blog that I update every day. It's got a terrible URL, rather. Sorry, I'm dyslexic all of a sudden. Okay, it has a terrible URL. It's like Reflections on Film and Television. I've had the blog for 12 years. When I started, I didn't know what I was doing. I should have been called like Fanboy or something. I think someone else has that now. But what I would do is go to my old website, which is johnkennethmuir.com, and then just link there, like go to my blog. Just click on my blog. I haven't updated that site since 2005. But but hey, if you want to look for me, find John Kenneth Muir there, and then click on my blog. It's updated every day. Last week, I looked at all the Conjuring movies and associated films, and this week I am looking at the three Purge movies.
Oh yes, I saw Election Year recently. I really love the Purge films. I think
I do too.
They're really underrated, I think, again, because they go into lots of depth about and they've got lots of ideas. So no, it's Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, that'd be
great. So I was thrilled by those two. They conform to my theory. You know, it's like, you know, great visuals, but also you're like taking the culture and reflecting it back at us and showing us who we are or who we could be.
Absolutely. Yeah, couldn't agree more. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, well, definitely check out that blog, guys. It sounds awesome. It sounds like something that everyone will enjoy, and you can find new things on. So that's great. That's great. We are available as ever on Twitter at @X_cast. If you look us up on there, follow us on there. And we're on Facebook at the X-Cast. We've got a great community there, loads of members, lots of chat about the X-Files every day. So come and join us if you haven't already. We're obviously on iTunes. If you go to the X-Cast, do subscribe. If you can leave us a review and a rating, that'd be even better, because then we can get more known. And you can find all our episodes on Libsyn if you just type in the X-Cast. So we're all there. We're all over the place. We're everywhere. You can find us. And we're continuing to go through season two. So yeah, we'll be back to some brand new episode reviews and in-depth analysis very soon. One more thanks, John, for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be back soon, guys. But remember, as ever, until next time, trust no one.